The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events here at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And tonight I am particularly happy to be able to say that the stars have finally aligned and we have Carlos Fuentes joining us. It's taken years to get him here, but something magical must have happened. And the fact that he's going to be interviewed by his translator, Edie Grossman, will make it an especially unique event. With more than 20 books to his credit, as well as a list of awards and honors longer than I am tall, Carlos Fuentes remains Mexico's best-known and most widely read writer. In his book, This I Believe, Fuentes writes that in our time, the novel is a kind of calling card that represents the cultures that, far from having been drowned by the tides of globalism, have dared to affirm their existence more emphatically than ever. It is this riotous and hydra-headed existence that Mr. Fuentes captures and creates in his new novel, Destiny and Desire, the posthumously told tale of two orphan boys whose intense intellectual friendship collides with the fantastical, political, and economic landscape of Mexico's history and future. The Los Angeles Times calls the book an endeavor that only a writer of Fuentes' formidable literary skills, broad historical knowledge, and well-earned self-assurance would be advised to even attempt. And the only reason that the Times critic can make such a laudatory claim is due to the formidable literary skills and artistry of Mr. Fuentes' translator, Edith Grossman. Ms. Grossman is the winner of the prestigious Penn Ralph Manheim Medal and the translator into English of many of Mr. Fuentes' Spanish language contemporaries, including Maria Vargas Llosa, Mayra Montero, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It is my honor, my pleasure, etc., to welcome Carlos Fuentes and Edith Grossman.
I suppose you wonder why we've invited you here tonight. I'll be asking Carlos some questions, some of them having to do with translation. Can you all hear me? Some of them having to do with translation, some of them having to do with his reading habits, and some of them having to do with Mexico. And then after we finish talking about these topics, we'd be happy to open up the floor to you folks for questions as well. So forgive me while I read. I won't remember everything that I wrote down if I don't. The first question I just found out the answer to, and that is, do you ever read translations of your own work?
In the languages I know, if I get a translation from China or the Ukraine, I'm helpless. Sometimes I'm very surprised because the novel The Death of Artemio Cruz was published in Moscow back in the 1960s. And I recall that the original work had about 500 pages, but in Moscow it had been reduced to about 90 pages. So I say, what's wrong? Did this novel go on a diet or what? Said, no, we are your friends. We took care of you. What do you mean? Yeah, we eliminated all the erotic and political passages. So I'm surprised there are 90 pages left.
That's very funny.
What could you do? What could you do with this, huh? I can get mad at you if you eliminate something. You know, I once had a translator, and I was reading my book in translation, and I came up on passage. I didn't write this. What is this? So I told him, "Hey, what is this?" He said, "I wrote it." "But it's my novel." He said, "No, but if I don't get published through your novel, I don't get published at all." You see what translating means, the fidelity of Edith Grossman. Bravo.
On the other hand, you know, English is always briefer than Spanish. So any novel that I do that, say, has 500 pages in Spanish will have 375.
I had that
experience. It's the nature of the language.
You know, I have that experience. I made a series called The Buried Mirror. It was made by the BBC, and yet I insisted, you know, the crew, everybody was English-speaking, but I had to give a Spanish version. I wouldn't do otherwise. So I did it, and there was the English version that lasted 60 minutes. Then the Spanish version lasted 65 minutes. The same words, inevitably. It's a longer language. I don't know. It's richer, maybe. Huh? Is that?
I'm not answering that question.
Okay.
Okay, we'll move on. A good number of English language writers, especially poets like Ezra Pound and Richard Howard and William Carlos Williams, have been translators. And I was wondering if you've ever been tempted to translate.
I did translate when I was very young, and for his misfortune, not mine, I translated T.S. Eliot. But again, it was longer than T.S. Eliot, inevitably. But, you know, poetry is practically impossible to translate.
Oh, don't say that.
No. You do a new poem, basically. It's a new version. It's a new poem. You cannot translate a poem in a literal sense. Hmm?
You can't translate prose literally either.
No, but you're nearer, whereas the poetry becomes itself plus the version of the translator, which can be very beautiful. Sometimes the translation is better than the original. That can also happen, you know.
No, you can't say that about poetry because...
Why?
In the summer, I'm publishing my translation of the Soledades.
Oh,
so that...
You got into trouble.
It was very hard.
Extremely hard.
Very difficult.
Very Baroque and very convoluted. But that helps also. You can betray Góngora more than any other poet because he's so difficult. You can get away with murder, huh?
All right, I'm not responding to that either.
I'm not getting any answers.
Do you read fiction when you're working?
Oh, lots of it.
I read lots of fiction. You don't feel as if it interferes?
No. I read it. My work day is very disciplined. You know, I get up early and I write from 8 to 1. Then I take a brisk walk. And then I read from 4 to 7, more or less. And I read fiction for 1 hour, and I read books of sociology, philosophy, whatever. But I do keep abreast, I think. I have assimilated all my influences. I don't think I can be influenced anymore, so I can read freely without saying, God almighty, I'm going to write like Faulkner, which I did for a long time, you know.
Yes.
Yes.
It's somebody...
Now she's responded.
Well, somebody once called Faulkner the best-known Latin American writer in English.
He was.
And I think there's a connection between Faulkner and Latin Americans.
You know, everybody, García Márquez, Vargas Llosa, myself, we were all devotees of Faulkner. Why? Because Faulkner was the most Baroque writer in the United States. He made us believe that Latin America began in Oxford, Mississippi. Right away, close to us.
And, you know, he read Don Quixote once a year.
As I do. But unfortunately, not in your translation. I read the original.
I'm sorry to hear that.
So am I.
Okay, we're moving right along, as you can see. Do you have a favorite author? And can you think of the writer who has had the greatest influence on you?
Yeah, obviously, they're both the same. And it's Cervantes. Cervantes is the fountainhead of literature in the Spanish language, novel in the Spanish language. He's also the founder of the novel, the modern novel as we conceive it. You know, the English can be very particular and say, no. The novel begins with Smollett and Tom Jones, Fielding, this and that. No, I think it begins with Cervantes. And that begins as a revolutionary act, which you have captured in your translation, and it is that the novel, as Cervantes conceives it, is the genre of all genres. You have the epic, mock epic of Don Quixote, the picaresque of Sancho Panza, you have a pastoral novel, you have a Moorish novel, you have a Byzantine novel, you have a novel within the novel, and then the authorship is thrown into absolute doubt. Who wrote Don Quixote? Was it Cervantes? Was it a Moorish scribe called Cid Hamete Benengeli? Or was it a novel found in a wastebasket? I don't know. He really poses all the great creative problems for the modern writer. They're all there. He was unpopular for a time, because Enlightenment could not understand Cervantes or Shakespeare, by the way, very, very well. Voltaire hated Shakespeare, for example. But for us, he has come back in full force as the great master. We all derive from him, we all learn from him, and I also read him once a year, but in Spanish.
But in Spanish. You've taken care of my next question.
Have I?
Because I was going to ask you about Cervantes and...
We can talk about Cervantes more if you want.
Well, I'd be happy to. Uh-huh. You can never get tired.
No, they're good. You've done such a great job, you know, because there was a time when one read the Smollett translation, which read like an 18th century English novel,
right.
Not like Cervantes at all. But you have brought Cervantes right into our own time, without betraying him in any moment.
Oh,
it is not
nice.
Anachronistic, but it is always present. And you read it as a modern contemporary novel, which it is. If you try to take advantage of poor dead Cervantes and transform him into a difficult author because he is dead and of the 16th century, you betray him, really. Cervantes is always claiming a present. Writers have many presents. That's why the job of translator is so important. You always realize that the writer is present today, and he is not the writer who was present for Tobias Smollett in the 18th century. It's very different. There's a new Cervantes. It's Cervantes for the 21st century, and you've translated him. That's great. I applaud that.
That's
thank
wonderful.
You.
Now, the Spanish... A Spanish author whom I've translated, Julian Rios,
yeah.
I had sent him a New Year's letter when I was about to start Quixote, and I said to him, I can't tell you how excited I am about this project, but I'm terrified. The idea of translating Cervantes is just overwhelming. And he said, no tengas miedo. He said, don't be afraid. Cervantes is the most modern writer we have. All you have to do is translate him the way you translate everybody else.
That's
and
right.
it
very
was very liberating to me. I thought, that's
that
right.
Wonderful.
I don't need to be afraid.
Well, Rios is a very intelligent man.
Yes, he is.
But he had you here. Great.
Yeah,
very
he
good.
Is. Okay. Which younger Mexican writers should we be on the lookout for?
Let me tell you something which is very interesting. We did not have great novelists in Latin America in the 19th century, with one great exception, the Brazilian Machado. Machado de Assis was a splendid writer because he recovered the tradition of Cervantes. We denied the tradition of Cervantes from Mexico to Argentina. We were trying to write like Balzac or other European writers. We disregarded our own tradition. Machado did not. Then came a great revolution in language, which was the Nicaraguan poet Rubén Darío. Rubén Darío really took the Spanish language, put it in a cocktail vase, and shook it up. He was sometimes cursi, he was great, he was fantastic, he was terrible, he was everything. But he let the language be free again. And from him came the great poets like Neruda and Vallejo, and from them the novelists renewed the genre, like Carpentier, Borges, Onetti, Rulfo. And from them, my generation, which were about 10, 12 people. But now I was at the Salon du Livre in Paris last year, which was dedicated to Mexico, and there were 47 Mexican writers, novelists present, 47, instead of the 5 or 12 of my generation. Now there were almost 50 new writers from Mexico. What happened? There was a process of liberation, I think. Our masters, like Carpentier and Borges, recovered the language. Then I think that my generation, the boom generation, as it was horribly called, tried to make explicit the history of Latin America. So we come from this. A lot of lies have been told. Let us add the great lie of fiction, which is a liberating lie. It's the lie that is nearest to the truth. And we wrote the novels you know very well, García Márquez, Vargas Llosa, myself, Cortázar in another vein, many writers. And then the writers of today have been liberated absolutely, because now they speak about conjugal relations, about children, schools, politics, waterworks, dividing the land, what happens in the mountain. They speak about every single subject under the sun. If in Mexico we have 50 novelists, imagine if you add those of Argentina, Chile, Colombia. I'm giving a course at Brown University later in the year about the new novelists from Chile, Colombia, and Mexico. And I'm being very selective, because I could go on from country to country.
Sure.
It's a great boom. Now is the boom of the Latin American novel, and everybody seems to have something to say that is new, personal, and that adds to the tradition. Because this, I think, is the great secret, is that you are creating, but you only create if you respect the tradition, your tradition, and that tradition only lives in the measure that you create new works. And that is a wonderful sensation. Because it is false and it is pedantic to think that you are creating all by yourself. It isn't true. You belong to a tradition, you prolong that tradition, you enrich that tradition, and the tradition enriches you at the same time. That is, I think, the secret of writing, in a sense, not all senses, but in a sense, yeah.
Now I have a silly question to ask you.
You're incapable of making a silly question. I don't believe you.
My beating heart. I am curious as to where you learn the street slang that's in your novels. That, for me as the translator, is probably the most difficult part. I mean, for me, when I need slang in English, I eavesdrop on the subway, and I try to get near a couple of teenage boys and listen to them speaking, and I pick up words I didn't even know existed. And I'm curious as to what you do.
That's a very tricky question, and I hope my answer won't be too tricky. I learned it because in the 1950s, I was a terrible parrandero. I spent my night in cantinas, bordellos, this and that, hearing the language all the time, hearing the language. I had a very good friend, a very good writer, Salvador Elizondo. We went together to nightclubs. And he said, "You're ridiculous. You're taking down the language you hear." I said, yeah, I didn't know I was going to use it. I had no idea. But listen, if you read the first Mexican novel, El Periquillo Sarmiento, The Itching Parrot, by Fernández de Lizardi, you need a glossary at the end.
It's
because he uses the popular language, the vocabulary of the people of the early 19th century, and you can't understand it. The same way now a novel like La Región Más Transparente needs a glossary at the end, or nobody understands many of the locutions. And then I try to keep an ear open to what is happening today in Mexico, but it's very difficult, because the nature of slang is to renew itself constantly, to leave previous forms behind and invent constantly new idioms. I love to see gangster films of the 1930s, because before movies were silent, suddenly you have Edward G. Robinson or James Cagney speaking locutions that have to do with murder, assassination, and they have remained somehow in the language. But to come back to the original point, the language of the streets is by definition renewal, constantly new. How do you keep up with it? It's very, very difficult. At my age, it's almost impossible. Yet I do have a certain ear, and once, and when I don't have the ear, you know what I do? I invent words. Everybody says, oh, how well he knows the popular language. Not true. They're invented
words.
That's why it's not on Google. That's why you suffer a bit. These are invented words. Why not?
Of course.
Joyce invented the language, didn't he? Yeah.
That's wonderful. Now, I won't feel so bad if I know you're making the words.
No, you make them up in English for me, would you? Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. His name just dropped out of my head.
Who?
Luis Rafael Sanchez, Puerto Rican novelist and playwright. He invents words as well.
Oh, yeah,
he does neologisms that are just perfect.
You know, he has this great novel called La Guaracha del Macho Camacho, and it happens during a traffic jam in San Juan. And the character is stuck inside his automobile, and all he can do is listen to the radio, to the music, to the popular vocabulary. Whatever comes through the radio is his novel. It becomes his novel. And I told him, Luis Rafael, was this ever on the radio? He said, no, it's mostly invented. Which is, I mean, the great example, of course, is always James Joyce. He invents a language for Ulysses, a language that is only James Joyce's. And why not? Why not? Will that enter the mainstream? Who knows? Who cares? It's in the book. It's there. It exists.
Good. I have actually one last question. I'm sorry. People here can ask you questions.
Yeah.
The last question that I wanted to ask you is if you think you are creating a new mythology for Mexico.
Oh, my God, no. You can't add more mythologies in Mexico than you have. No.
Well, a new one to replace the old one.
No. We live oppressed by so many mythologies. You know, I was giving a course at Harvard once on the origins of Latin American culture. I went to Rome, because Roman law is essential for the understanding of Latin America. You have the common law, we're inheritors of the Roman law. I went to the Middle Ages, because the greatest political philosopher of Latin America continues to be St. Thomas Aquinas. He tells us how to rule, how to govern ourselves. Then I went to the Renaissance, etc. And a group of students came up to me and said, why do you go back so much to Rome and the Middle Ages? And I asked them, hey, when does USA history begin for you? And they answered in a chorus, 1776. That is the beginning of history. And the rest, I asked them, what's the rest? They said, oh, that's Cecil B. DeMille. Anyway, but it's a problematic thing, because to live with so much past is difficult. Mexico and Peru, besides the Spanish colonial past, have the Indian past, the Aztec and the Quechua past to deal with. And when you say Spanish past, you say the Mediterranean, you say Rome and Greece and the Phoenicians and the Arabs and the Jews and the whole panoply of influences that you are battling with all the time. And I say it's a great facility to assimilate things and go forward. We're always stuck a bit in the sense that our inheritance is very complex, very heavy, very beautiful, but we have to deal with it somehow. And one of the ways of dealing with it is writing novels, of course, and letting the tradition flower in a way.
I've never forgotten the analogy you drew in Change of Skin, which is a book of yours that I love dearly. When you drew the comparison between the Aztecs and the SS.
And the SS, yeah.
Yeah, it was.
It was a totalitarian regime, the
it
Aztecs.
It was stunning. Yeah, it was just It's a great novel. When did that come out?
1967. But the Aztec regime was not a dainty regime. It was a very totalitarian, terrible regime. I mean, if you sacrifice people and tore their hearts out. You know, the interesting thing about the conquest of Mexico is how the two civilizations blended finally, you know? Because the protagonists of the conquest were Cortes, who was a very strong, bloody, forceful Spanish captain, and La Malinche, who was his Indian translator. But you could not live with the tradition founded on Cortes and La Malinche. What the Catholic Church did was to transform Cortes and La Malinche into Jesus Christ and the Virgin of Guadalupe. Now we can adore them. Now we can go back to our foundation with a sense that we are the inheritors of Christ and the Virgin. I went to a wonderful Holy Week in Mexico is extraordinary because it is celebrated in different fashions by different peoples in the country. And I once went to the Cora region, which is somewhere between Nayarit and Jalisco. It's very remote, very remote. And what happened there was that it was settled very lately by the Spaniards, and they built a church. They asked the Indians to help them build a church, an altar. And suddenly one day the friars, the Franciscans, came in and found couples making love in front of the altar. And they were scandalized. But the Indians said, "Didn't you tell us this was the temple of love?" So they chased the misioneros out. The church is still semi-built only. It's a ruin. And they decided to interpret La Semana Santa, Holy Week, Easter, in their own fashion. So you have the Stations of the Cross, you have everything, but it's very peculiar because I asked the man who was playing Christ, I said, "It's fantastic, it's been 2,000 years and you're repeating this great drama." What drama? He said, "The drama of the Calvary and Jesus Christ." I said, "No, no, what is that?" I said, "Well, I think you're representing it." He said, no, I'm not representing that. "Why are you carrying a cross? Why are you bleeding?" Says, "I'm representing the creation of the world." So it's another vision of things, very different from ours, you know, very different. Well, that's it.
Let's keep the questions going. Raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you. Please wait for the mic, gentlemen, about four rows back. Please wait for the mic, sir.
Señor Carlos Puentes, ¿cuántos Méxicos ha vivido usted? ¿Uno, dos, o varios?
We can get a live translation.
How many Mexicos have you lived? And you said a lot.
And I still have many left.
Another question. Gentleman about in the middle there, six rows back.
Yeah. If I might, I'm going to ask you also in Spanish. Actually, I had two questions. La primera, su obra es muy extensa, son más de 50 años escribiendo, pero yo crecí con La Muerte de Artemio Cruz, era el libro obligado y es un
obligado.
Libro...
¿Obligado?
Obligado.
Let me interrupt for a second. This gentleman is saying... I don't do simultaneous interpretation.
I know, and I was...
this gentleman is saying that you have an extensive work and have been writing for more than 50 years. The work that he began with, because it was obligatory, was The Death of Artemio Cruz. Fair?
Yeah. De todas formas... Inicialmente pensaba hacer una pregunta más política, pero porque recuerdo que creo que fue cuando murió José Saramago, usted dijo que lo que se recuerda de un escritor es su obra literaria, no su ideología. En este momento tengo una bebé de apenas 6 meses y en 12, 15 años quisiera recomendarle un libro suyo. ¿Cuál sería ese libro que, si pudiera escoger uno de todos esos?
He asked me to recommend one book out of my ever, and I can't do it. because I love all my children. Some of them are beautiful, some of them are crooked. I don't know, but besides, you know, my whole work comes under the title La Edad del Tiempo, the Age of Time, an ambiguous title. But everything is comprehended in it, so I can't separate. And I can't answer your question because I can't dismember my own work.
So, déjeme hacerle otra segunda pregunta que de pronto esta es un poco más fácil o no sé. Pues el año pasado Vargas Llosa recibió el premio Nobel y siempre, pues de pronto he considerado que junto con García Márquez, Vargas Llosa y usted eran los, quizás los más candidatos a recibir el Nobel. Usted habla un poco de la literatura en México, es muy extensa, igualmente se pasa en Colombia, en Argentina, pero ¿habría alguna otra persona, sin mencionar su nombre, no porque está aquí, pero lo considero que es digno de ganarse el Nobel, ¿habría algún otro escritor que merecería ganar el Nobel en Latinoamérica?
No sé si en América Latina, pero en España hace mucho que no lo dan. Goytisolo lo merecería, por ejemplo, Juan Goytisolo. Pero lo demás es muy difícil de contestar. Yo lo recibí cuando recibió García Márquez. Me doy por contento. No pido más.
The question was about the Nobel Prize and who in Latin America, who else in Latin America should receive or should have received the Nobel. And Carlos said he was satisfied when García Márquez won it, but our eyes should turn to Spain, and Goytisolo is a writer who certainly should have received it. Mm-hmm. I would add Borges. It's amazing.
But Borges went to beg for the prize. You don't get it that way.
Did he really? Oh, now that's a story I didn't know.
What is that story? Can you tell that story? Can you tell that story?
No, I can't.
All right. We will continue, and I'd ask that you help us continue in English because we are not paying Edith to be a simultaneous translator. Gentleman in the fifth row there.
So, Mr. Fuentes, first of all, it's an honor for me to have you here. The first book I ever read of the Latin American boom was Aura by you. But my question is more regarded to the... You mentioned before you were very similar to Faulkner, but I would also add another author that is not so close to us right now, and that would be Ginter Grass. Do you believe there's also an influence by him? Because I
What is the name?
Ginter Grass.
Ginter Grass is of my same generation.
Yes.
So it's very difficult to have...
Well, it's not an influence, but you mentioned how Faulkner was very similar to you guys, and I believe my...
Well, Grass also, I mean, there's a general mood of modern literature in which most writers participate. There's a lot of points of contact between Günter Grass and Juan Goytisolo and Nadine Gordimer and most of the writers writing today. So, yeah, you're right.
Okay. Let's continue. No. Come on, people. We've got 20 minutes, and you're not going to have another opportunity. Lady about eight rows back, please keep your hand up.
The first row is very, very, very nervous. They want to ask questions.
We'll go to this gentleman next.
Carlos, over here. Can't see me.
In the middle there.
Hi.
Please, whoever makes the question, please get up so I can see.
Hi there. A two-part question, because I'm getting all kinds of greedy here. The first part is, when did you first know that you were going to be and that you were meant to be a writer? And my second question is, present moment, what truly inspires you to write?
First question, I was in school in Santiago, in Chile, when I was 11 years old, and... a very distinguished journal, the Boletín del Instituto Nacional de Chile, which was founded by Victorino Lastarria, asked me for a collaboration on Mexico, and I wrote a little piece on Mexico called Estampas Mexicanas. I read it and blush now. But at the time it was well received, and I was very happy that I had finally published something. Then I was in the prep school in Mexico, and there was a literary contest in which we had to submit works with pseudonyms. And, well, when the prizes were proclaimed, I had won first, second, and third prize. So my friend said, okay, you win. We'll go to politics. We'll keep literature. We'll become politicos. So those are my beginnings. Although, you know, my father helped me a lot because my uncle was a very good poet and writer. He died very young of typhus in Mexico when he was 21, 22. So I'm named after him, Carlos Fuentes. And my father always made me read a lot and made me feel that I should be a writer. But he didn't like it when I said, I'm not going to law school because I want to be a writer. He said, you'll go poor. You'll be un miserable. You have to have a title in Mexico. And he was right. So I studied law, and I'm very grateful for it. And then I started writing.
Licenciado.
Licenciado. If you're not licenciado, you're nothing. Right?
The other half of her question
was the other half of the question?
What inspires you?
Nothing. I don't believe in inspiration. I believe in hard work. No inspiration.
Well, I'm going to tell you why we're nervous. We're very nervous because we're truly honored you're here today.
Thank you.
As Hispanics living in the city, we feel like you're the Pope visiting, finally. You know, a land of the unfaithful.
Speak a little bit louder.
Very honored to have you, Mr. Fuentes. And my question is very simple. You said that the Spanish language was liberated by Rubén Darío, who took that cocktail, put some tequila, cerveza, and other things, and shook it and liberated it. That language headed north after several decades and came into the U.S., 50 million of Hispanics live in this country. And I would like to ask you, what do you think the destiny of that language is going to be in this new land where the Spanish language is surrounded by Alambre de Púas, English?
No, I think the English language is a great language. It is not surrounded by Alambre de Púas. It is a magnificent language. It is the first language of the West. We come second. And the number of people who speak it. But you know, this country was built to a certain degree by migrants. But migrants that came overseas from Europe. This is a novelty that now the migrants are coming back, are coming into the United States from the South, from Mexico and Latin America. And besides, God forgive me for saying this, they're coming back to lands that once belonged to Mexico. I'm saying it very simply. I'm not being a provocateur or anything of the sort. But I think that the United States is a multicultural and multilingual nation. Finally, our friends from Mexico and Latin America will speak English. And they may speak Spanish as well. Same way that Polish migrants speak Polish and English. German migrants, German and English, etc., etc. So it is a presence that enriches the United States as a multicultural and multilingual society. I'm very happy for this because this is a great nation, and the fact that there are all these potent forces in favor of multiculturalism, I think is very important. I think President Obama made a very important declaration a few months ago, which I find hasn't been underlined enough. And he spoke of a future global society in which work would travel freely. Because right now you have merchandise, money, values can cross borders, but not people, not people. But we have to consider a future society in which migration becomes much freer than it is today, in which the personality of migrant workers is respected much more than it is today. And I recall that, read that speech by President Obama. It contains a kind of interesting promise, which I hope will become true, and that we will live in a truly global society in which each of us can give the best we have to other societies.
I wanted to comment on that, if you don't mind, that you didn't ask me the question, but I think I live in New York, and New York for me is like the frontier of the Roman Empire. There are languages being created that did not exist before. I have heard combinations of English and Spanish that are a whole new language, and that leaves me breathless. When a stock boy in the supermarket says, "I don't know anything about that. You have to talk to the Noche Man." And I think, the Noche Man? That's the most mysterious thing I've ever heard. Or somebody says, "Tómalo easy." And my favorite is "Dame un break." Which, you know, this didn't exist before. It didn't exist in English, and it didn't exist in Spanish. And that's the beautiful part of those cultures coming together. And I don't find it a weakening of either language. I find it expansive for both of them.
You're right.
And now you can go to, a lot of those phrases are, if you go to urbandictionary.com, a lot of them are, as well as a lot of other slang phrases, but there are these amalgams of Spanish and English that are up there that you can look up, and then the definitions are often a little suspect, but very entertaining. Another question, second row right here, and we'll go over to you.
Hi, Carlos. You probably don't remember me, but I know that this is not your first visit to Philadelphia. I know that this is not your first visit to Philadelphia. I think of you every November 11th and every July 7th. Because the first is your birthday, as you revealed in Christopher Unborn, I believe. And July 7th, I don't exactly remember the year, but you were teaching at Princeton, and my husband was there as an NEA fellow, and we brought you down, took you to the art museum with your daughter, and gave you a nice picnic on the river. So that is always in our hearts and in our heads. But we had told you a couple of times from Terra Nostra and other books of incidences where we were reading your books, and it connected exactly with the moment that we were in. In Terra Nostra, for instance, I was reading about the Mexican earthquake in 1987 when it was actually happening. Yeah, it was amazing. But Christopher Unborn, I was.
Do you have, ma'am? Do you have a specific question?
Okay.
Because we need to keep going.
Oh, okay. Yes, we at that time we talked about the coincidences between what you write and what was happening. I wanted to give another example, but can you talk about the contemporality of your work in that way?
No, I'm not aware of that, you see. If I were aware, I wouldn't write. Okay. Because if you're looking at the, saying, oh, I have to be present, I have to be actual, I have to be contemporary, you don't write good books. You write bestsellers, but not good books. And there's a lot of people who write with an eye, saying, what will interest the public most, and what is a novelty? I've never thought of that. I write what I want to write, what I have to write, what I feel like writing, without looking at the newspapers, practically. So I can't answer your question in that sense of linking myself to the actuality. If the books have an actuality, it is because of their merits, not because of the actuality. You cannot be a slave to that at all. You must transcend that. You must incorporate it if you want to, but don't be beholden to the newspaper headlines. Don't do that. Well,
in the front row here.
Anyway.
Mr. Fuentes, my name is Ivonne Malaber from Aldea Newspaper. And I just interviewed this way to the director of La Academia Norteamericana de la Lengua, and he's talking about the term hispanounidense. What do you think about this term, and what is the best way to define us, the Latino in America?
Well, I don't know. I know that Latino has struck a bell, and it's very popular, but most of us in Latin America have nothing to do with Latinos. Latin is Rome. Mm-hmm. It's a Roman Empire. Very good. But if that simplifies the question, yes, what are we? We are Ibero-Indo-African people. Mm-hmm. We're basically derived from Spain, from the Indian worlds previous to Columbus, and to the African migration into our countries. That is our makeup, really. And when I say Spain, I already said it. We're saying Rome, Greece, Arabs, Jews, a million things. The examples of Moorish architecture in Mexico are astounding. How do they cross the ocean and be there in Mexican churches? So what is extraordinary about it is, call us Latin Americans, call us Hispano-Americans, Ibero-Americans, whatever you wish. But never forget that we are the heirs to a very, very rich culture with many strands in it, many, many strands. Not a single strand, but many strands. That is what makes us up, and I think it's a wonderful thing. Because I, as a writer, have many traditions from which to draw, many ideas, many sensibilities from which to draw, and I think that enriches me, at least me personally, very, very much.
Yeah. Lady in the second row right here.
Could you talk about the relationship between the author and the translator? For example, do you choose the translator? Or how does that come about?
Maybe you could both talk about that.
How does that come about?
And the relationship, too. It'd be interesting to hear a bit about that, the back and forth.
All right, the relationship. I tend not to speak to the author until I'm finished. And then always, first of all, I believe the author has a good amount of things to do. Secondly, by the end of the book, I know what I need help on. And there's always 10, 15 moments in the novel when I'm not really certain what is intended. I'm not certain that I've understood it correctly. And since most of the people I translate are living, it makes it very easy to get in touch and say, do you mean this? Did you mean that? And everyone is always very generous. A few years ago, I started doing 16th and 17th century Spanish writers, much to my surprise, I must say. And of course, short of channeling, there's no way I can consult with anyone in the 16th or 17th century. Which does give me a free hand, because they're dead.
Don't you think that. They will hunt you.
Moving
well,
on.
I answered my part of the question, so.
Yeah, the gentleman on our left.
No, sorry. Did I interrupt you?
One question with two parts. What do you think of the work of Arturo Pérez Reverte, and what do you think of the detective novel as a vehicle for serious literature?
What was the second question? I'm sorry.
What do you think of the detective novel as a vehicle for serious writing?
Yeah, well, I like Pérez Reverte very, very much. Pérez Reverte has a great sense of public readership. He's a man who respects the reader very much, and that, in my turn, I respect. He has drawn an extraordinarily rich picture of the past of Spain, which proves that the past is always the present, that the past is never totally preterite, that a brilliant young modern mind can bring the past to the present, as Pérez Reverte does. So I have a great admiration and respect for his work. The second question was lost a bit because of the microphone. What was it?
Do you think?
Oh, no, a detective novel is wonderful. I read it one a week. And I'm sorry, I've read through all of Ellery Queen, all of Dorothy Sayers. I reread Sherlock Holmes, but Carter Dixon, my God, I've read every single detective novel under the sun, and I want more detective novels because they are the wonderful. I mean, I can't write a detective novel, and I don't think any novelist with a serious intent can write a detective novel because a detective novel always needs a guilty person. First, there's a moral issue, which, as a writer, you avoid. You don't think everybody's that guilty. And then, because the novel, the detective novel, has to have an ending, a very precise ending. Hercule Poirot says, you come here to the dining room, and I'm going to reveal that one of you is the criminal. Everybody's, who? And he goes through the reasons of each one and says, you. And then that guy jumps through the window, tries to flee, but is caught by the police. And that's the end. I mean, that's not a Faulkner novel. I mean, it's very entertaining. I find it wonderful because of all the wiles, the rationalizations, everything that goes on is extraordinary. I think it's fantastic. I admire that very much. But it is precisely an indication of what I should not do. And I love that.
Yeah. I'm right here in the fourth row.
Hello. I'm very touched.
Please rise. Let me see you.
I'm very touched by the fact that you have said that your inspiration is work. I think that's what I heard you say.
That's part of my German ancestry.
And I have a question, a parallel question for Edith, which is that I'm wondering what your passion is. I feel that there must be some passion for you to give voice to someone else's tongue. And I was wondering if you could just speak to that. And I think it's just kind of interesting that the author who's considered the creative force says that work is his inspiration. And I suspect that you have a passion behind your work.
My passions. I have more than one. I think my two greatest passions are music and literature. And if I had a second life to live, I would be a blues singer. There's no doubt in my mind that that's what I would do.
Why don't you begin now?
I don't have time.
Translating.
And literature has always moved me from the time I was a little girl. It's something that's been very important to me. And I am very lucky because I like and often love everything I translate. I have never had to deal with a book that I thought was so terrible that I could not wait to be finished with it. I mean, I often want to be finished with a book, but it's not because I hate it. I remember when I was doing Don Quixote, there were weeks when I thought, I'm never getting off of page 375. I will spend the rest of my life trying to, you know, like a surreal movie. I will spend the rest of my life trying to get this page right. So those are my passions. Is that what you meant? Am I answering your question?
Who are your favorite musicians?
Well, let's see. I guess my favorite jazz musician is Dizzy Gillespie.
Okay.
And I think my favorite composer, classical composer, it's a little hard to choose. It's kind of neck and neck between Mozart and Beethoven.
Neck and neck.
You know, I can't choose. And then there's always Stravinsky, who I like a great deal.
Stravinsky's a great model for a writer because he was booed when he started. The Rite of Spring, people left and screaming, hating him. And now it's part of the canon. There you are.
It's interesting life, isn't it?
Very.
Okay, there's a lady in what seems to be turquoise to me about 12 rows back, and we'll stay back there, and then we'll go to the gentleman in the third aisle here. Yeah, to her, the one standing.
Hi. So I took a course this past semester on Latin America, and this is really brief background. I'll get to the question quickly. And essentially, the overarching theme of the course was, first, does it make sense to call Latin America Latin America? And then second, pardon me?
I've answered that.
And then second, does it make sense to assign all these countries together under that one name, despite the similarities in their histories? The countries of Latin America are inherently really, really different. So I was wondering if you could maybe speak to the idea of grouping them together and then also using, like, the ironic name Latin America when the term Latin comes from the Romans.
You know what? I realize when I go to international conferences, I realize that each country has its own national interests at heart, and it's very difficult to move anybody from their national positions. But there's a wonderful thing that we all understand each other. We all speak the same language. We all have the same cultural heritage. We have the same authors in mind. I think that is, I don't know what's going to happen in the future if we're going to become one continent as Bolivar wanted. I don't know. Maybe yes, maybe not. But the fact is that for the moment we have a great cultural unity. And that speaks volumes about the reality of Latin America. Or Ibero-America, or Hispano-America, or Indo-Afro-Ibero-America, whatever you want to call it, we have an extraordinary culture. We're very conscious of that culture. As writers, as musicians, as filmmakers, we all contribute to that culture, and it becomes ours. It belongs to every one of us. But the disparity between the cultural achievements and the lack of achievement in the economic and political fields is enormous. So a lot of the question you're asking has to do with this tremendous disparity in which culture unifies and politics separate, or politics are not sufficiently at the level of culture. Politics are mediocre. We try to make them better, this and that. But there is no comparison whatsoever between the cultural achievements and the political misachievements. Is that a word in English?
You just invented it.
Good. You will put it in the book.
Absolutely. I promise.
All right.
And gentleman in the third row here.
Mr. Fuentes, you spoke, I thought, very touchingly about your hope for America. Would you talk a little bit about your hopes for Mexico?
Yeah. Mexico was on the verge of a transformation. The revolution, Mexico had a revolution. Revolutions legitimize. You have the great fortune in this country to have a revolution, the American Revolution, that began with a constitution, laws, and a politics that tried to reflect the constitution and the laws. Sometimes you have fallen into great pits, but always, boom, there comes a new president who restores the sense of the law and the constitution. It's the case of Obama right now, I think. But in Latin America, in Mexico particularly, we had a revolution, the 1910 revolution, that was the legitimation of governments. We knew that there were failures in these governments, but Vasconcelos came and gave education to a country that was 90% illiterate. He sent teachers to the haciendas. The teachers came back without nose, without ears, or they were killed by the hacendados who did not want the peasants to read and write. So from 90% to the effort to educate, to sanitize hospitals, communications, there were wonderful things that modernized the country under a regime that was not democratic, that was authoritarian, or light authoritarian, but authoritarian. La dictadura perfecta, as Vargas Llosa said once. But there came a moment when the revolution lost its legitimacy, and that happened on October the 2nd of 1968. When peaceful demonstrators, young men and women who were asking for more democracy, were mowed down by orders of the president. So that changed everything. The revolution lost. The government lost its revolutionary legitimacy. It tried to restore it. Finally, Cedillo says, okay, let the opposition take place. The opposition has been a continuation of the PRI governments. This has little to do, you see, with what is happening in Mexico. In Mexico, we have 50 million people who are less than 30 years old. It's a vast, vast number of people. What are they going to become? Are they going to be ninis, as we call them in Mexico? Ni estudian ni trabajan. Ninis. No. Are they going to be captured by the allure of the drug gangs and the criminals in Mexico that offer easy money, sex, and early death? Or are we going to be able to offer them a new constructive plan for Mexico? And boy, do we need it. We need better ports. We need urban renewal. We need communications. We need schools. We need hospitals. We need to recreate our country for the novelty of the 21st century. The last great public works were done 50, 40 years ago in Mexico. We have to renew this. There are no good roads from the Gulf to the Pacific. There's so much work to do in Mexico that I cannot tolerate that we tickle ourselves to death and are very happy. Because why? Because we have workers that come to the United States and send us dollars. We have tourists. We have oil. All these things are going to go down. And we're going to have to rely on the capacity of Mexicans to work, to find new avenues of work. And I don't think the present political system offers that to the young people of Mexico. So we're going to have a political renewal. I don't know in which sense it'll go. I don't know who will be the head of it, but I'm sure that in the next few years, and we have a presidential election in 2012, in which all these forces are going to come to the fore, and hopefully we're going to have leaders and ideas and people that say, now that is over. That is the past. Let us work for the future in this sense and bring all the young people of Mexico into the working force of the country, and that will be the great jump Mexico has to make. I didn't want to make a political speech, but you forced me.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I see we still have hands, but we need to keep moving on. So please join me in thanking Carlos Fuentes and Edith Grossman.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.